Got it going both ways. But where? There? Okay. Huh? Can you hear me now? Fine. I'll stay near the pulpit. Oh, what? Harrison loves playing those little jokes on me. He just likes, it's a way of keeping me humble. Just when I think I've got it. We're going to be going through Genesis really fast, even though we're going to be in it for half a year. We're going through pretty quickly, and there are going to be some things that are going to come up that we're not going to have time to deal with. And so I'm going to kind of cheat, and occasionally when I get a chance to preach, I'm going to take some part of Genesis. I'm not promising this, but it might happen more than today. But today I particularly did want to deal with one of the things that we're going to come up on pretty soon, and there are some questions about it, and I want to talk about them. So let's talk today about the Nephilim. They're found in Genesis chapter 6, if you'll go ahead and turn there. And while you're turning to Genesis chapter 6, I want to kind of set up the background for this discussion. In chapter 5, you don't have to go back there. Stay in 6. I'll be with you in a moment. It begins with, this is the book of the generations of Adam. In the days when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female. He blessed them. He named them man in the day when they were created. But once you get past that initial idyllic plan of God, I'm going to make him in my image. They're going to be like me, male and female. They're going to be my people, and they're going to look like, sound like, talk like, think like me. It all goes bad. You know that. It was back there in chapter 3. And so things start falling apart. Wheels come off. And in chapter 5, verse 5, begins this litany that goes all the way through chapter 5 that reinforces they didn't live the way they were supposed to live. And it's all a result of sin. When Adam was cursed in the garden, it says, from the dust you were taken, to the dust you will return. You're going to die. And so in chapter 5 and verse 5, it says, so all the days of Adam that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And then you go down to verse 8, and all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. 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 8 times people die. And it's meant to say, this is what sin has done. This is what sin has done. This is what happens when you don't live the way you're supposed to live. And then you come to chapter 6. Now, it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And then the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. So let's talk about those. There are 3 big questions that come from these first 4 verses of Genesis chapter 6. First of all, the question, who are the sons of God and the daughters of men? Who are they? And secondly, Why is God upset? And third, who are the Nephilim? Who are these guys? So, I'm going to offer to you the first of two possible explanations as to who the sons of God are. This is number one. The sons of God are angels, and the daughters of men are humans. And you may say, I've never heard that before. I want you to just keep an open mind for both of these views as we go through them and look at the evidence from the text, all right? First of all, you need to know this was the view that was held by most early Jewish scholars. If you go to the Jewish rabbinical writings, almost without exception, this is the view they held, this one. That the sons of God were angelic beings and that they had relationships with the daughters of men. It is the view that was held by early church scholars. Not all, but many of them. I just listed a couple. Ambrose, Tertullian, Cyprian, and Clement of Alexandria all held this view. Now, I'm telling you that not because, oh, that proves it, it's right or wrong. I don't believe everything the Jewish scholars believed is true. And I don't believe everything that Ambrose or Tertullian or Cyprian or Clement taught or believed is true. That's not my point. But what my point really is this. You cannot say, well, that where did that new idea come from? This is as old as the earliest writings of the church fathers, and even before them, the rabbinical writings of the Jews. This was the view that was held by most people early on. And again, the fact that it was early doesn't make it right. But the fact that it was early does mean it's not new. It's a very old position that was held. You also need to know that the sons of God, that phrase, sons of God, is a peculiar phrase. And if you go to Job chapter 1 and verse 6, you will see that the sons of God came into the presence of God to make their appearance, and among them was Satan. That these are angelic beings in Job chapter 1. These are not human. In Daniel chapter 3 and verse 27, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are walking around in the fiery furnace, when Nebuchadnezzar looks in, he says, Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of that fire? Well, I see four men. They're unbound. They're walking around. And the form of the fourth one, not all of them, the form of the fourth one is like a son of God. In other words, he has the appearance of deity, the appearance of angelic being. That's used that way. Exact same phrase that you find here, the sons of God came to the daughters of men. The same sons of God phrase that's found in Job 1 and in Daniel chapter 3. But I really need you to concentrate on the connection of this section about angelic beings as they are found in 2 Peter. And I would encourage you, we're going to stay here for just a moment, not a long time, but enough time that I would encourage you to go ahead and turn in your Bibles and look at this with me. In 2 Peter chapter 2, 2 Peter chapter 2. In this chapter, Peter begins talking about rebellious opposition to God's will. He says false prophets rose among the people in verse 1. There'll be false teachers among you. They'll introduce destructive heresies. They'll deny the master who bought them. And look at verse 2, because it begins a focus on the nature of these particular rebels. Many will follow their sensuality. And because of them, the way of the truth will be maligned. And then you go down to verse 4, where it says, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but he cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and he did not spare the ancient world, but he preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter. And if he rescued Lot, righteous Lot, oppressed by," look at what he's oppressed by, "the sensual conduct of unprincipled men. For by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds." And then you go down to verse 10, "especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and despise authority." Now, jump over just four books to the very small book, it'd be to your right, the very small book of Jude. Commentators have noted for centuries the parallels between Jude and 2 Peter. It's almost like they were writing about the same thing at the same time, and they even appear to be using exactly the same terminology. So if you go to Jude verse 6, he says, "Angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper mode or abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day." Now read with me down to verse 7. Just as, look, get the connection, stay in the connection. As he, in verse 6, angels didn't keep their domain. And then verse 7, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they, in the same way as these, indulged in gross immorality, and they went after strange flesh. They are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. In the same way, these men, verse 8, defile the flesh and reject authority and revile angelic majesties. All right? That's a lot of reading. We're going to come back to it. But I want to just suggest to you, these are things to note that support the idea that the sons of God are angels. That phrase is used of angels in other places, and it seems to tie in with 2 Peter chapter 2 and what those angels did that warranted God's punishment. The second idea for the text in Genesis chapter 6 is this: that the sons of God are the righteous lineage, the people that obeyed God, followed God, and the daughters of men are the ungodly lineage. And the idea of this is that in this day, people who were righteous kind of abandoned their righteousness and they compromised it by engaging in marriages and sexual relationships with women who were wicked, and it compromised the purity of the earth. That view was held by, and I know some of you are going to try to correct me on this, I love living in America. In America, you have the right to be wrong, and you can exercise that right. But I know how the city's pronounced. It is not St. Augustine. It's St. Augustine. and I will refer to him as such. This view was held by Augustine, and it was held by Calvin, and it was held by Luther. Those are pretty powerful men. Those are great Bible scholars. I'm not scoffing at all at their ability to dissect and understand the scriptures. They held this view. That was their view. And it is, I admit, the most common view taken today. If you go to commentaries today, most commentators will say that's what Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4 is about. It's about righteous people watering down their faith by intermingling with unrighteous people. And I'll give you one more. Sons of God in the book of Hosea, chapter 1 and verse 10, are people, not angels. In Hosea says, where it is said to them, you are not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. Sons of God there, a similar phrase to that found in Genesis, here is used of people. So some would say, well, if sons of God in Hosea is people, then sons of God can be that in Genesis. And I will not argue that that's not possible. So now let's get into it. Here is the first assertion about that first view. Assertion one is, Matthew 22 and verse 30 indicates angels cannot cohabitate. Cohabitate is a redundancy. It's a word brought to you by the Department of Redundancy Department. Matthew 22:30 indicates angels cannot cohabit. Well, let's look at Matthew 22. Let's go back there and see what's being said. Some Sadducees in verse 23 come to Jesus and they basically say this. So this man died and his brother went into his wife, the widow, and he married her and was going to raise up children. And there were seven of them, and each one of them died, the second, the third, all the way down to the seventh, and then the woman died. And in verse 28, they ask, in the resurrection, therefore, whose wife of the seven will she be? For they had all married her. And then they sat back real smug. Yeah, take that, Jesus. You believe in the resurrection, so what's going to happen to this woman who goes to heaven and she got seven husbands? Is she married to the first one or the last one? Or to all of them? Is she a polygamist in heaven? What happens? And Jesus answered and said, you're mistaken. You don't understand the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels in heaven. They are like the angels in heaven. So let me give you a reaction to this argument. Does Matthew 22, verse 30, and let me make sure you understand the argument. The argument would be this. Ralph, if that first idea is true, that angels came down to earth and they intermarried with women and they cohabited with them, how do you explain Jesus' statement that angels don't marry in heaven, which seems to indicate maybe they are asexual beings? You know, they don't have male or female characteristic. They're not male and they're not drawn to women or females. They are not given to marriage. Matthew doesn't say they can't. He just says they don't. There's nothing in the text that indicates angels cannot have sexual relations. It just says they don't. Their purity, you know, Jesus made the statement one time. He said, some are born eunuchs and some are made eunuchs by men and some are eunuchs for the Lord's sake. And he says, Paul says, that's a great gift from God if you can do that, if you can devote yourself utterly to Jesus. And some religious groups have adopted that idea and they've made their most holy people celibate. And the idea of that is they're so committed to God, they have no connection with sexuality here because they want to focus completely on their relationship with God. And we tend to admire people like that and say, what a great sacrifice they made. Who better to do that than the angels in heaven? Jesus did not make the statement, they're like the angels, they can't have any kind of sexuality, but rather that they don't. Look, I don't eat liver, but it's not I can't eat it, it's that I don't eat it. But if you put me in a situation where I haven't had anything to eat for a month, I'm going to guarantee you I will eat liver. It isn't that I can't, it's just that I don't. And in the same way, the angels, it's not a matter of they can't. I think it's a matter of they don't do that. Look at again at Jude 6 through 8. Go back to that if you need to, but let me remind you of this. It says the angels abandoned their proper abode. I believe the proper abode for angelic beings is celibacy. They don't have sexual relationships, and particularly with humans. They don't have that. But it says they abandoned that. And it puts it in the context, in Peter, of sensuality. It says, in the same way as Sodom and Gomorrah. What happened at Sodom and Gomorrah? They abandoned their proper abode, men desiring women and women desiring men. They abandoned that and they desired that which was wrong for them. In the same way, the angels abandoned their proper abode. So if that's not referring to this, what is it referring to? When and where did angels abandon the proper relationship they're supposed to have to God and to humanity if it's not right here in Genesis chapter 6? The men of Sodom, just as the angels, in the same way as these, gross immorality, went after strange flesh. Those are all the phrases that say, in the same way, in the same way as these angelic beings have done. So I believe that isn't an answer sufficient to me to say, well, there's no way the angels could have done that. The angels did something to abandon their proper relationship. They did something. And it was gross immorality. It was sensual in nature. All of that is in the text of 2 Peter and Jude. And it seems to me to fit perfectly what we're talking about here. The second objection or assertion is, wait, righteousness versus unrighteousness really fits the theme of Genesis, Ralph. The idea that it's sons of God are righteous people, daughters of men are the unrighteous, and it seems to me that fits the theme a whole lot better than what you're talking about with this aberrant behavior on the part of these angelic beings. It just seems to fit the theme better. Now, let me offer just a couple of suggestions about that by way of reaction. First of all, have you not found it interesting that it's only sons of God that are righteous, and only daughters of men that are unrighteous? Where are the daughters of God and the sons of men? Why doesn't it go both ways? Is it really that the women are the only ones who could be unrighteous in this situation, and that the sons of God, only men, could be righteous before God? Because if we're talking specific gender here, and we are in the text, well, it seems like women get a real bad break here. But I want you to consider another thought. I do like this idea of a theme. I think there is a theme in Genesis. And, I just realized, I keep pointing back here, but you're here. So there is a legitimate theme in the book of Genesis, this idea that the righteous versus unrighteous is found throughout that book. Because you got Cain versus Abel. You got Seth versus Lamech. You got Noah versus the world. You got Abraham versus Canaan. You got Joseph versus evil. That's righteous, unrighteous, righteous, unrighteous, righteous, unrighteous. It is a good theme. But I would also suggest the theme of desiring to be like God is also prevalent in Genesis. I mean, really prevalent. You've got the serpent who usurps God's authority. You've got Eve who saw that the food was desired because it would make her as wise as God. You've got the Tower of Babel, let us make this tower. And God says, they're trying to be like us. You've got the rebellious world here in Genesis chapter 6 that is just thumbing its nose at God. The whole world is doing that. That's a pretty prevalent theme in this book. And it seems to me that that fits as well, if not better, than the theme of righteous versus unrighteous. Let me offer one more thing about this. The Nephilim fit this theme. The Nephilim fit the theme of somebody trying to usurp the power of God in their place. You know, you've got to deal with this. Let's go back. Suppose the story really is about godly people marrying ungodly people. The text in Genesis 6 is very clear that the righteous people marrying, or the sons of God marrying daughters of men, resulted in the Nephilim. It's not just coincidental. Their cohabiting resulted in the Nephilim. You go back again, listen to this reading, Genesis chapter 6. It says, when men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. They took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And then it says, verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men. So we're not just talking about, well, this sin happened when righteous people married unrighteous people. And by the way, it so happened that was around the same time as the Nephilim. It is very clear there's a connection between those marital births, those marital relationships and births, and the Nephilim. They are the result of sons of God and daughters of men intermarrying. The word Nephilim means the fallen ones, those who have been at heights and fallen. Look, if I fall down, that's a long way to the ground compared to my grandson, Jet. But my going to the ground from 6 feet up is nothing like Shaquille O'Neal falling to the ground at his 7 foot plus height, or that new freshman at the University of Florida who is 8 foot tall. Giants falling fall. I mean, they go down, and it's a long way. But the word here for Nephilim has both the concept of giants, height, and fallen. The idea that they are the result of this effort to usurp God's proper design for his beings. It appears from the text that it happened more than once. Because it says, in those days and also afterward. Because I know where some of you were. I sensed your objection, and it was this. Well, Ralph, that's Genesis chapter 6. And if they produced giants, the Nephilim, they all died in the flood. Pew, done. So that doesn't account for Goliath or the sons of Anak, the Anakim. Doesn't account for them because they came after the flood. And if this happened one time, all of those would have perished. Good argument. I love that you're listening. I love that you're thinking ahead. But it says it happened again. Now, I don't think it happens all the time. But there evidently was multiple times when this event happened. When the sons of God came down and bore children by humans. And the result was, wow, giants. I mean giants. So when you go to the passage in Numbers 13, and the children of Israel are coming into the land of Canaan, it says, we saw giants in the land. And it says, it refers to them as the Anakim. Giants are in the land. Deuteronomy chapter 1, same thing. We were as grasshoppers in their sight. There were giants in the land. We're not talking giants. We're not talking 6'5". We're talking giants. I mean, remember this. Goliath is not 7 foot tall. Shaquille O'Neal doesn't come up to the shoulder of Goliath. He hits him about sternum. Think about that. Shaquille O'Neal. Goliath is 9 feet tall. And there are more giants than that. In 1 Chronicles chapter 20, there's a whole list of giants that were in the earth. 1 Chronicles 20, 5 through 8. In 2 Samuel chapter 21, Goliath has a whole family of these giants. This is not an aberration. We're not talking here about just a genetic deformity. Like, where's Bob? Bob Dunn? Huh? Wadlow, thank you. I was going to say Waldorf, but Robert Wadlow was an aberration. I mean, he had a pituitary problem, thyroid problem that caused him to be as tall as he was. But these are giants, and there's more of them than one. Where did they come from? I believe they come from this very incident. This is the kind of thing that happened. So, again, listen. Do you want to walk out of here today saying, I heard the arguments, I still think it's righteous men and unrighteous women? Take that up with your girlfriends. You do have to answer that. I mean, why is it that it's only men that are righteous and women that aren't? Why is it that way? You do have to answer that. But you're still fine if you want to take the view that that's what it was. I don't know for certain. I'm not saying this is a doctrinal matter that will consign your soul to hell or to heaven if you get it right or wrong. That's not my point at all. I'm simply giving you an explanation based on what I think are also the evidence in the New Testament. Whatever happened here, you've also got to deal with whatever happened in 2 Peter and in Jude. There's also things going on there with angelic beings we've got to find answers to. I find comfort in dovetailing those and seeing that they're both talking about the same situation. That's my best shot at it. But let me close with this. The story of the Bible is that of righteous potential turned by going one's own way. That's a story of the Bible. That's a history of man. Because who among the righteous is not tainted? Adam, Noah, Abraham, Jacob, Judah, Gideon, David, Solomon, Hezekiah? Who doesn't go bad? But there's a son. There's a son of Eve, a descendant of Eve, who was able not only to save himself, but to save us as well. And he can face the giants of sin, and he can face the rebel forces and factions, and he can eradicate them and blunt their power. So though those forces continue to be active and dangerous, I haven't even begun to speak about Ephesians 6:12, we struggle against the rulers, the authorities, the cosmic powers of this darkness, against evil spiritual forces in the heavens. I haven't even spoken about that because David Bricky has begged to speak on that in the near future. He says, I want that text. Those forces continue to be active, but we have assurance there's a champion fighting against them for us. We have a champion. And in his power to crush the serpent and his offspring, we are more than conquerors. The victory belongs to Jesus Christ, not to the aberrant, to the rebellious, to those who would usurp the power of God, but to those who bow the knee to Jesus Christ. And that's where you need to be, because we have a wonderful Savior, and he can be yours. If we can help you this morning, our lesson wasn't designed to tell you how to become a Christian, not at all. But if you're wanting to know how to become a Christian, don't leave this place without saying, hey, tell me how. I want to know a little more about that. I want to understand what it means to be a Christian. We'd love to talk to you about that. But if you know, and if you've been putting that off, get out of the rebel forces and join Jesus Christ and his conquering army. We invite you to do that as we celebrate this wonderful Savior. You come while we stand and sing this.